Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What can nuclear energy do for you? And should you be worried about what its production might do to you? For nearly a century, physicists have been gaining knowledge about what happens when particles collide and trying to harness the resulting energy to power and protect their fellow citizens. We're all aware of what might happen should nuclear weapons fall into the wrong hands, but as my guest today has learned, even peaceful nuclear development under the direction of responsible scientists can not only go horribly awry, but is almost certain to facilitate weapons research. Stephanie Cook is an editor for the Energy Intelligence Group and contributor to the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientist. Her new book is called In Mortal Hands, A Cautionary History of the Nuclear Age. Stephanie, welcome to Think.
Thank you. It's nice to be with you.
You characterize the nuclear story as one that promised a big enough prize to keep everyone enthusiastic, but that in the end has consistently proved too dangerous and too expensive to really deliver. Will you talk about that?
Well, you know, if you think back to or realize that at the beginning of the atomic, well, not at the beginning, but say in the 50s, when they were starting to think about developing civilian nuclear energy, there were forecasts that there would be 1,000 reactors by the year 2000, that we would have eventually have breeder reactors producing endless energy through the recycling of nuclear fuel and the production of plutonium. And there were other great dreams that they would use nuclear explosions to carve tunnels across the country and widen the Panama Canal and move mountains and all of that kind of thing. And a lot of that never happened. And what you have instead are about 100 reactors in the United States, a little more than that, producing electricity, and worldwide nuclear contributing about 15% of the global electricity output, which is not a lot considering the billions of dollars that have been poured into it. It has also led to two very bad accidents, one of which didn't turn out to be as awful as might have been, but Chernobyl certainly was pretty bad. But there were many, many other accidents that the public was not well aware of. The reactors sort of sit amongst heavily populated areas and pose a kind of continual, although the chances of a serious accident are low, the consequences are very high. And that sort of presents us with a sort of weird combination of giving us something, but at the same time posing a constant threat. And the biggest thing, and as far as I'm concerned, is that the trade in civilian nuclear commerce has led to other nuclear weapons programs.
Well, let's step back for just a bit and talk about how nuclear energy works. You've come up with a really terrific way, I think, to illustrate the process using a big container full of ping pong balls.
Yeah.
Will you talk about how those balls interact?
That I was describing the process of enrichment, and basically, you know, I think the way I described it is that you picture a space filled with white balls and a few black ones mixed in, and you get sort of bullets, which are actually neutrons in the atom, flying through space, and when they hit a white ball, they are absorbed, but when they hit a black ball, it splits and shoots a few more bullets. That's basically what happens inside natural uranium, which contains less than 1% of the isotope that fissions, in other words, causes the chain reaction, which is the heart of nuclear energy. And the isotope that fissions is the rarer isotope called U-235, which is represented by the black balls. I'm sure your listeners are terribly confused right now. But in any case, what happens is that in these enrichment plants, like the one at Natanz in Iran that's so much in the news today, you increase the number of black balls so that you get this shooting effect happening more frequently, and that's why you call the uranium enriched, because this isotope of U-235 has been increased relative to the U-238, which is the one that occurs more frequently in nature.
So in its natural state, uranium would have a great deal of those white balls that are not so active, the U-238, yes. and just a few of the black ones, U-235. But then enriched uranium, as in for weapons, would need 90% of those little black balls.
Right. You can actually use less, you can enrich it to less than 90% and still apparently use it for weapons. But 90% and above is of the ideal mix.
So what's the difference between nuclear power used to generate energy and nuclear power used to detonate bombs?
Well, the level of enrichment in a nuclear reactor is much, much less. It's much lower. It's about 3% as opposed to 90%. So, and the different the big difference between a bomb and a reactor is that in a reactor, the fission is basically controlled. In a bomb, the idea is to let it go out of control. What happened in Chernobyl, of course, is that they lost control. There were too many control rods that were up at the time of the accident, and that's why the reactor exploded. So that, which demonstrates that even with lower enrichment levels, there is always this danger.
So, as Robert Oppenheimer understood from the very beginning, research for the two uses, energy development and also weapons development, is intractably interchangeable and interdependent. Is it impossible to have nuclear energy without nuclear weapons?
You know, nothing's impossible. I think it's hard to imagine that happening, I guess. I'm not quite sure how it's all going to play out, but... Nuclear energy, I have a hard time imagining how nuclear energy would have developed without the weapons. I kind of put it the other way around, because the weapons were the reason that Eisenhower wanted to develop nuclear energy. He needed to have a kind of a happy message or a positive message alongside this rather depressing, alarming message about weapons, which at that time they felt were here to stay forever, basically. They couldn't see a world without nuclear weapons. And so they said, we've got to have nuclear energy, so there's a better side to this story. But the infrastructure that was required to support the development of nuclear energy was essentially there because of the bomb program. And, you know, leaving aside for the moment the high cost of reactors, it's hard to see how utilities at that time, who most of which were reluctant to develop reactors, would have financed the development of nuclear fuel plants to feed the reactors. Had Congress not already done that during the war years, unknowingly, by the way, because it was during the Manhattan Project that those first plants, like at Oak Ridge, were built. But you have to have this enormous infrastructure to support the industry, and that's what people forget about, I think. And it's very costly. And the type of enrichment plant we use in the United States is incredibly energy intensive because it's gaseous diffusion. We're moving away from that, but haven't succeeded in doing so quite yet.
So Eisenhower in 1953 created this initiative, and you mentioned it was sort of selling the benefits of nuclear power while we were also developing weapons. It was called Atoms for Peace, and it was international in scope. Can you talk about what it entailed?
Well, the idea was that we would actively promote nuclear energy development overseas, and actually, it was in this era that the seeds for two of the early bomb programs in India and Israel took root. That was one of the consequences. Another consequence of Atoms for Peace was, well. It also, Atoms for Peace, by the way, allowed the British and the French to kind of, the British had already exploded a nuclear weapon, but the French hadn't yet. That wasn't until 1960. But that allowed them to kind of tell their public that all these wonderful reactors we're running are for energy and electricity. In fact, they were really dual-use reactors intended to produce plutonium for the weapons program in the main. At that time in 1955, which was 2 years after the Atoms for Peace speech, there was a big conference in Geneva at which scientists from all over the globe congregated and talked about, they were all very excited about developing nuclear energy. Eisenhower, I will tell you something very interesting. Eisenhower had devoted exactly two sentences in his Atoms for Peace speech to the subject of safeguards. And one of the points of my book, and the thing that it just amazed me as I was writing it, was the extent to which nobody was prepared for the consequences of these of developing nuclear energy, what it would bring in the main proliferation. And one of the things people don't realize is that after that big meeting in 1955, there was a much smaller meeting of delegates from just six countries, the United States and Russia and Canada and Czechoslovakia, because they're big uranium producers, and the British and the French were there. I think the French were there. And they were meeting because they said, gosh, we do have to deal with this problem of how we stop the spread of nuclear energy for clandestine purposes, because all the scientists knew that if you run reactors on enriched fuel, once a country has the capability of enriching uranium, it can enrich it for either a reactor or it can enrich it for a bomb. And they knew that, you know, then you get make spent fuel, and then you can put it through a reprocessing plant, and in a reprocessing plant you make plutonium, and a plutonium is good for a bomb. In fact, it's the preferred route. So they had this meeting, and it was the American delegation was led by an eminent Nobel laureate called Isidore Rabi. And I acquired in the course of my research access to the diary by one of the British scientists who was at this meeting. And he said that it became evident just as the meeting began that nobody had been prepared for what was about to happen. And nobody had prepared any ideas. Nobody had any ideas about how to safeguard this material. And he said no one wished to speak. Several times we sat for 10 minutes on end, eyes cast down, doodling. The stenographer's fingers remained poised over the keys. The interpreter sat alert but silent, and so on and so on. And he described it, this trap of silence that descended on the chamber for more than 10 minutes. Well, they finally came up with a sort of phony idea of tagging material with some kind of isotope, but they knew it wouldn't work. But they pretended it would work, and then everything kind of spun off from there. Gradually, they set up the International Atomic Energy Agency, and people started grappling with the issue of how do we deal with proliferation. But the agency that was set up in Vienna, the International Atomic Energy Agency, which is in the news all the time nowadays, was basically set up as a kind of organization of scientists to talk about and promote nuclear energy, and the safeguards thing was a sort of afterthought. And inspections and safeguards were minimal for 20 years or more. And even now, today, they are certainly not up to the job of what they're tasked with. Their budget is about $100,000 a year, which is the equivalent, I think I write in my book, of the Redskins, the Washington Redskins football team personnel role. So the problems that we had from nuclear energy, particularly proliferation, started almost right away, even before Atoms for Peace. But Atoms for Peace certainly fostered it. And we really, you know, 60 years on, don't have an answer to these. We have some, you know, ideas we're going back to that were around in the 40s, like, you know, international fuel banks. But it's hard to see that these are going to solve the problems of Iran and North Korea, and it's hard to see that. I mean, there's not a lot of enthusiasm for them, and so it's hard to say how this is all going to play out.
Stephanie Cook is my guest. She is editor of the Energy Intelligence Group and a contributor to the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists. Her new book is called In Mortal Hands, A Cautionary History of the Nuclear Age. Coming up, we'll talk about how nuclear waste is treated, and we will take your calls at 1-800-933-5372. You can also send an email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, helping you to get ahead in today's tough economy. Hundreds of courses begin this summer. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Stephanie Cook. She is editor of the Energy Intelligence Group and a contributor to the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists. Her new book is called Immortal Hands, A Cautionary History of the Nuclear Age. If you'd like to join us, you can send an email to think@kera.org or you can call 1-800-933-5372. So, Stephanie, Congress has set aside $96 billion for this place out in Nevada called Yucca Mountain, which is supposed to take all of the nuclear waste generated by all the power plants in this country and take the waste and put it in one place. Where are we on that?
Well, actually, Obama has basically scrapped Yucca Mountain. He scrapped funding. He's left funding in the most recent budget only enough for the NRC to continue its review, but for all intents and purposes, it's considered sort of dead in the water at the moment. And at the same time, they've put some funding in for a commission, a sort of blue ribbon commission, to review other options. So it looks like we've gone back to square one after 25 years since the Waste Policy Act was first passed in 1980.
So in the meantime, you have waste sort of piling up in repositories at the places where it's generated.
Yeah, what you have is you have a situation. I think the worst situation is the reactors where about 95% of the spent fuel is currently stored in densely compacted spent fuel pools. And a former DOE official I spoke with recently said that if someone drained just one of those pools, you could render an area the size of Connecticut uninhabitable from cesium exposure. At other sites like at Roe, Massachusetts, where the reactor's now gone, it's been dismantled and shipped off to, I think it was Savannah River, the citizens are left basically for the foreseeable future with about 90 acres of spent fuel where there are 16 large concrete steel-lined casks containing spent fuel. And they have to kind of monitor this. And, you know, when you think of nuclear energy, you know, it's true that in volume terms, the nuclear waste that is produced is not a large amount. But in terms of what it leaves generations to deal with, it is pretty big psychologically and from the point of view of, you know, you kind of think, gosh, if I lived in Roe, Massachusetts, where would my property values be if I lived near this place with all this spent fuel? And the fact is that, you know, at some level they have to pay for this because, you know, they have to spend town council time and meeting time dealing with this. The NRC is their, you know, their sort of port of call in Washington, but they don't, you know, they have a responsibility too, so this will be passed down the generations. I don't think that we will see a national repository for 30, 40 years, maybe. I don't know. It's hard to say, but we were supposed to have had one by 1998, and we haven't.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak to Larray in Dallas. Hey, Larray.
Hi, thank you for this show. I wanted to ask your guest what she knows about the use of nuclear waste being used, depleted uranium being used to code missiles and other armaments, and how that poses a detriment to human health.
Stephanie?
Yes, I'm not very expert in that particular area. My impression is that depleted uranium is not as dangerous as some of the other things, you know, relative to many of the other things which you know, weapons bring about. I thought for a minute that you were going to be asking about using nuclear waste to reprocess for use in civilian nuclear energy, which is a whole other aspect, but using depleted uranium on weapons is obviously not good if it gets into the environment, and it's caused a lot of, I know there was a lot of controversy about it in Iraq. It's not clear to me how much harm it's caused. It's not something I've studied that closely, so I'm afraid I can't answer you very satisfactorily.
Well, let's talk for a minute about the relationship between civilian nuclear power generation and military weapons development, because both of these are actually under the purview of the Department of Energy, as opposed to the weapons portion being run by the Department of Defense.
Well, actually, partly it's under the, yes, it is under the Department of Energy, and then there's, you know, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, which is supposed to monitor safety issues. There is a link, though, I mean, between the department. I think the problem we have just basically right now, and I wrote an op-ed piece recently in the New York Times about this, which is that the Department of Energy has been so heavily biased toward nuclear energy for all these years because it is essentially the spin-off of the old Atomic Energy Commission via an organization, you know, I can't think of the name, you know, that existed for 2 years before the DOE. But in any case, there was a sort of segue period. But Carter tried to make a true energy department, and then it got kind of killed under Reagan. But I was arguing that, and I still believe very strongly that this country needs a dedicated, really focused energy department that's thinking about what are the best energy options for this country. What you have is a department that is dealing with that problem of energy, but also the weapons, the cleanup, and the result of this is that 2/3 of the DOE's budget is on nuclear, basically nuclear weapons and nuclear cleanup. And then and a lot of the funding goes to the DOE labs, which were nuclear orientated, and so you basically don't have a this has sort of lumbered the Department of Energy in a kind of handicapped the country as a whole in terms of what its best energy options are, because the bias was always towards nuclear. It also got the lion's share of the R&D spend on energy, which was minuscule in any case. But it just hasn't been good for in terms of our country's what we're going to do energy wise.
So, in other words, when Americans are looking at the Department of Energy's budget, if they're not going by line items, they might imagine that a lot more money is being spent on things like renewable and sustainable energy.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. And right now, a lot of money is going to be spent on renewables under the sort of recovery package that was passed, the 2-year recovery package, but the basic underlying spending patterns are still the same, and even in the 2010 budget, they're still the same. Now, the Obama administration is talking about moving all that nuclear activity out and putting it in the Pentagon, which is causing a lot of controversy. The comments on all of this are not due till September, so we'll see what happens, and it remains to be seen how much political capital they'll put behind this. But it's important to highlight that, because we don't have a very focused approach, and you're right that most people, and myself included, for a long time I thought that the Department of Energy was what it said it was, but it really isn't. And there are other ways, you know, in terms of crossing over between the military and civilian uses. I mean, for example, they use reactors at the Tennessee Valley Authority to produce tritium for the weapons program. So in other words, the electricity juice that's coming out of those reactors, to turn the lights on in Tennessee, that reactor is also being used for a weapons program. So it's not a very clean, it's cleaner than in most countries, but it's not totally clean in this country.
Stephanie Cook is my guest. Her new book is called In Mortal Hands, A Cautionary History of the Nuclear Age. Let's go next on the phones to Rob in Allen. Hello, Rob.
Hi. I wanted to get back just a second on the question of disposal of the waste, because I don't feel that we have to invent everything in this country. And France has been doing this to a larger degree than we have for the last 40 or 50 years. What is their method of disposal?
The French have not, also don't have a repository. They have a place in eastern France that they're still investigating, but they, like us, don't have it set up. They don't have it approved. It's still in kind of relatively early stages. The French program, by the way, has made some missteps. They were heavily invested in the idea of breeder technology, and they still are to some extent. And the British were. And they tried to, we were at one stage, and so they took all this fuel and they put it through a reprocessing plant to produce plutonium that was supposed to go in these breeders. And what they're left with is like more in Europe. I mean, England has like 100 tons of plutonium, which is, by the way, the same amount of plutonium we produce for our entire weapons program. And it's just sitting there, and they don't know what to do with it. They've had to set up a special commission in Britain to deal with it. They have a similar problem in France. You know, they're going to use some of it. They're going to try to mix it with fuel and put it in specially constructed reactors. It's called mixed oxide fuel. That's one mistake they made. The breeders were never successful. The second mistake is that they overdid it with reactors. In other words, they have too much base load capacity. And the result is that in peak periods in France, although they're a net exporter of electricity, they actually have to import electricity. And they are building more fossil fuel plants to deal with this problem. So they've kind of overdone it. I don't know, you know, France keeps going, though it has 59 reactors or something like that, where it's going to put all this stuff after a while. But, you know, it looks good from the surface, but look a little further beneath and you'll see there are some, it's not as rosy as it looks.
So this has come up in the interview already, but when decades ago proponents of nuclear energy were talking about nuclear becoming so plentiful that electricity would be too cheap to meter, we know that the cost of producing nuclear energy has fallen a bit, but why isn't it now too cheap to meter?
Well, actually, you know, it's true, the operating cost, once you erase the capital costs, it becomes reasonably competitive. But a new reactor now is priced at somewhere between $4 and $7 billion. That's one reason. It's, you know, they have so many, you know, with a reactor, and think of your plumbing system at home, but just like multiply that by 1,000 or 1,000,000 times and you have what you have in a reactor. Very, very complex machinery, very complex safety systems. And you know, just to keep all that going and deal with all the regulations and stuff costs a lot of money. It costs a lot of you have to sort of separate the capital costs from the operating costs. And these capital costs take many, many years to pay off. And you have to weigh that against the risk that the reactor is going to work well, that it's going to run for 40 or 60 years. And in the last period where we had big build, I mean, something like 50% of the reactors that were started or that were on the planning boards never materialized, and a lot of money was spent and wasted because they didn't take off. So it's a very, very complex way of producing kilowatt hours, very, very complicated. And, you know, you kind of, when I started this, I kept thinking, gosh, it's such a complicated way, and surely we can do it more easily and more elegantly. And that's kind of, you know, I still kind of think that we can, that if we hadn't had the bombs and been distracted by that, we would have probably figured this out a long time ago.
With a cost of $4 or $5 or $6 billion, can a reactor get built without government money?
Well, the utilities in this country are saying no. I mean, at least this time around, last time around, they didn't admit that. This time around, they're saying it outright. They will not do it without. Now, there's about 30, there's applications for about 30 new reactors. The DOE has granted, four of those reactors are in the running to get government money. The rest are not. So we don't know what will happen with those. The four that are in the running include two in Texas, but the DOE has not said whether all four of those are going to get funding. There's a pot of $18.5 billion that's being divvied up. The big question is whether the industry will be able to get more loan guarantee money for further reactors. And then the question is how many will actually get built.
1-800-9.
The United States, most people, we cover the uranium market on my newsletter, and most of the uranium people who look to where the business is going to be don't look in the United States. They look to China, Korea, and to some extent, possibly Japan, though that's a big question mark, too.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Luis in Dallas. Hey, Luis.
Yes, I think you just answered it a couple minutes ago, but just for the record, whenever it's taken to Nevada, what hypothetically could it be used for something else? The remains?
The radioactive waste?
Yes.
I don't know. Stephanie?
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear that question.
Luis is asking whether or not after, assuming a place like Yucca Mountain were to be created, and I guess, as you mentioned, it's offline now, but can that waste be used for any other purpose, or does it simply have to be warehoused indefinitely?
No, what I was saying is the waste can be recycled and turned into plutonium. That was always the big plan from the 50s. But that turns out to be also full of problems, because when you engage in trafficking plutonium around, obviously there's a risk that it'll get diverted. It's like, you know, multiplying the Iranian problem again, because, you know, twofold, because you know you not only have countries saying, well, we can enrich uranium, but we need to reprocess it, and you don't know whether they're reprocessing it for a civilian reactor or for bombs. And it's also very, very expensive. I mean, if you reprocess and then you put it in a reactor, it's the kind, you have this advanced reactor, which they tried in the 80s and 90s, and they were all failures except for maybe one in Russia. And, you know, so they this is just not a good idea. Carter stopped it in the late 1970s because he had experience in the nuclear navy during the war, and he knew how dangerous it was. And he said, no, we're not, the United States is not going to reprocess. Bush made an ill-fated attempt to try to revive it, but that's been killed by Congress now, and I don't think it's going to go anywhere. There are parts, you know, the Russians are trying to push it. People are, you know, it's not dead all over the world, but it's hard to see how far it's going to go.
Stephanie Cook is with us. She is editor of the Energy Intelligence Group and a contributor to the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists. Her new book is called In Mortal Hands, A Cautionary History of the Nuclear Age. If you want to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send an email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, helping you to get ahead in today's tough economy. Hundreds of courses begin this summer. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Stephanie Cook, and we're talking about her new book, In Mortal Hands, A Cautionary History of the Nuclear Age. We've already spoken, Stephanie, about the IAEA's budget, which would appear to be quite small compared with the task that it has to serve. I have to tell you, though, I was astounded to read about the way it ranks accidents and then pulls them off its public website after 6 months. Will you talk about that a little bit?
Yes. There was an excuse for that, something about that they didn't want to prejudice, that some countries didn't report, and therefore it didn't seem fair to those that did to have them there forever so that people could see them. But, I mean, that kind of tells you a lot, because the truth is the IAEA has always been very secretive, because it was not allowed to tell. A lot of its reports are not released to the public because without the country's permission, and a lot of countries don't want their dirty linen hung out to dry. There's a lot of things we don't know. I once spoke to he was an IAEA inspector, safety inspector at the time, not a safeguards inspector, and he said, you know, the scariest reactor I ever was at was in Holland. And I said, why Holland? You know, you wouldn't have thought Holland would have a bad reactor. He said, because there was this blinking light in the reactor, and they didn't know whether it was that the light bulb had gone out or whether it signaled some kind of danger. The IAEA kind of has to protect its client states who give it its funding, and that's at the bottom of all of this. you know, and a similar situation exists with the safeguards reports that don't, I mean, they come out gradually, but one was leaked recently about what they had discovered in Egypt, which is that there were traces of highly enriched uranium. I mean, you know, I think the IAEA has gotten the message over the years, and they're getting tougher, but they're very limited, but constrained because of being a UN organization. They just have so many kind of, you know, limitations, and they have this inherent conflict, which is that they promote nuclear energy, or as an IAEA official said, we facilitate it, while also trying to safeguard it. And I think that's also at the bottom of a lot of this, that they're promoting and trying to play policeman at the same time, and it doesn't. I don't think it makes for the best mix.
Well, and a few years ago, when you talk about self-reporting, Japan was supposed to receive this huge award for having made so many achievements and created all this safe power. And then less than a week before it was supposed to receive this, the very embarrassing news came to light that in fact, this nuclear power plant had not been reporting all of its data.
Oh, yes, for something like 2 decades. That's TEPCO, which is the largest utility in the world, Tokyo Electric Power Company, which has a very mixed record of of operations. They had covered up, you know, hundreds of safety defects over, I think, spanning 2 decades. Yeah, I was at a meeting in London, a nuclear conference, and this guy was supposed to receive the Mr. Nuclear Wonderful Man of the Year Award, and he and all of the Japanese representatives hadn't made it to the meeting because of this embarrassing thing with TEPCO. TEPCO also owns the largest nuclear plant in the world. It has 7 units. And in July 2007, there was a very bad earthquake, and it forced them to shut it down. Only this week we've learned that they are opening one of those units back up again. This is almost 2 years later. This has caused a huge, huge earnings losses at TEPCO, and it caused, in the first year of the outage, it caused almost a 2% drop in nuclear electricity output worldwide. That's how big the effect was. So, you know, we talk about nuclear and baseload, but when accidents happen or earthquakes happen, and Japan lies on an earthquake zone, there goes your baseload, and sometimes for a very long period of time. England had 4 nuclear reactors out for 17 months. They were in such a bad state of repair, and, you know, that was also a big drop in nuclear output. So the baseload is reliable to an extent, but only to an extent.
Let's go next to Augustine in Dallas. Hello, Augustine.
Hello, how are you?
Fine, thank you.
Good. I have a question in respect to the last comment from your guest. The budget of the IEA could be one problem, but another problem could also be that governments like the USA and Britain and others might not be sharing intelligence with the IEA in terms of its monitoring and regulation. The case in point is with Iraq. Apparently, IEA had different intelligence and the U.S. had different intelligence. And eventually we all know what happened. The next question is, what is the risk that the WIS is not eventually going to end up in countries where there are weak government and because of poverty and stuff like that and corruption, these government might accept these WIS and create a larger problem in those countries?
Yeah, is there anything, Stephanie, to prevent?
I didn't quite. I just had trouble hearing that last bit.
He was talking about what exists to prevent richer countries from taking and dumping their nuclear waste in places where governments may not be in a position to resist any kind of financial incentive that would come from dumping nuclear waste in a poorer country.
You know what I think would be the thing that would prevent that? It would be prevented by the fact that. I mean, you don't want to put your spent fuel in any other country outside of your control because it's material that can be potentially used and reprocessed into plutonium. So it kind of sort of exerts its own safeguards in that way. You lose control of your spent fuel, you're creating a danger zone. zone. So if that was your caller's question, that he was afraid that we would just dump it in some poor country that had no say over it, I don't think that's feasible. I don't think that would ever happen.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Patrick in Richardson. Hey, Patrick.
Hi. I'm calling to see if the author knows anything about... I read a little while ago that the first type of uranium enrichment centrifuges they were using were labeled P1 and P2. And then I recently read that Iran has been accused now through our spy satellites and their infrared imaging capabilities and whatnot, which is classified over my head, that they've been able to see now they're using a different generation of these called S1 and S2 that shorten the weaponization time that it takes to enrich uranium to a percentage where you can make fissile material out of it, or a weaponized bomb.
I think the big development that the Iranians made was that they were able to substitute maraging steel, which is hard to, which there were also the safeguards control, and use some other material, which I can't remember at the moment, like Teflon, or I just can't remember what the name of the material was, but that was one of their developments. But I think S1 and S2, I'm not sure whether those correspond directly with P1 and P2, which were the Pakistani centrifuges. Those, by the way, were the ones that were basically taken from an organization in Europe called Urenco by A.Q. Khan in the late 70s. And it's true. I think that the Iranians have made some developments and improvements. I think the Pakistanis did too, but I'm sure, but they got their start from this design, which is a shorter centrifuge, and that was the beauty of the centrifuge that was developed by Urenco. And that actually, by the way, if you're interested to know, is comes originally from a man called Gernot Zippy, who is an Austrian who spent 10 years after World War II in a Russian as a Russian prisoner of war under the terms of the post-war agreement. But the scientist lived in sort of gilded luxury, and he was charged with developing centrifuges because they didn't pay much. They thought gaseous diffusion, which was our technology, was more important. But it came from this Gernot Zippy's developments and his team in Sukhumi, which is on the Black Sea. And then when he went back, one thing led to another, and they formed this organization called Urenco, and ultimately his ideas came to fruition. But it just shows you how long the progression is. And then that went to Pakistan, and from Pakistan to Iran, basically that basic concept.
There are something like 9 states known to possess nuclear weapons today, 8 declared. But you believe that dozens more could have weapons if they chose to build them.
Well, there right now there's something. There's 56 countries that have civilian research reactor programs, and there are about 30 countries that have indicated they want to start some form of new nuclear programs. And of those 30, 14 of them are in the Middle East. You kind of have to ask yourself what's going to happen next. The man who was in charge of Iraq's nuclear weapons program, I ran into recently at a conference in London, and he's now living in Abu Dhabi, and he's got a lot of knowledge. I mean, the point is there's a lot of knowledge out there. The Middle East is sitting there with Iran very, uncomfortably. And the truth of the matter is you don't get into this ball game unless you start somewhere, and you're not going to start right away on weapons. You've got to get the expertise, and you get the expertise by getting a reactor and just learning about nuclear, and you do this under the guise of a civilian program. That's what every single program since the very early programs have done, and even the French and the British use this guise. Apart from the United States, Russia, and China, every single other nuclear weapons program has in some way been helped by the civilian nuclear industry. I'm not saying the civilian nuclear industry reached out to help them, but in some way they were helped by its existence and by the commercial trade.
The U.S. right now does get something close to 1 in 5 of its kilowatt hours of electricity from nuclear plants.
Right.
Can we get by without those plants?
You know, we haven't given it a really good try. I think that it's possible. I think that, you know, once we figure out more about, I'm not an expert in this area, but I've thought somewhat about it, and I think that, you know, if we start thinking about distribution in different ways, and we start thinking about sort of cellular distribution networks like cell phone networks, and we start putting more generation locally, you know, with everybody kitted out with solar panels and little windmills on their homes, maybe like we had TV dishes or something, and conservation, and I think it's doable. I do think it's doable. Certainly people that are far more expert in this than me, like Amory Lovins at the Rocky Mountain Institute, are absolutely, you know, have all the numbers to prove it. And we're not going to get rid of all the reactors tomorrow. They will continue to run, which gives us a lot of chance to find ways of replacing them, a number of years to find ways. But, I think we really have to do it, because I think that nuclear energy, for all sorts of reasons, is ultimately not going to work out. And, I mean, not just because it's dangerous, but because it's expensive and it's unwieldy. And my gut feeling is that over time we're going to look back at them and say, gosh, these were real dinosaurs we produced. That's my own feeling.
Do you sense a growing political will to get rid of nuclear energy in this country?
No, it's very mixed right now. Loads of people, I think memories are short. Lots of people, just panicked when they heard about global warming and said, well, nuclear's got to be an answer. And all they could think about was carbon-free. But there is also a movement. It's called nuclear-free, carbon-free. A man near where I live runs that, Arjun Makajani. I think that in the end it will just prove too cumbersome and too difficult, and the people that say yes to nuclear energy now have forgotten what it was like after Chernobyl. They've forgotten what it was like during Three Mile Island. You know, you need one bad accident, and first of all, you lose a lot of land. You lose your land. I mean, the people around Chernobyl, it disrupted so many lives for a generation or longer. They're still not living back in that town, a lot of them. And, it's just got so many. I don't think we need to live with so many risks around us. I think that's what we're talking about. Do we want to really shoulder all this, this potential trouble? And that's what, there are people that in the Obama administration that are definitely for nuclear energy, and because they can't see any other way.
Stephanie Cook's new book is called In Mortal Hands, A Cautionary History of the Nuclear Age. Stephanie, it's been so interesting. Thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.